Publishing Cox, a podcast about the book business. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Ron Martinez of Invention Arts. Hey, Ron, how are you?
Good.
Hi, David. So maybe you could talk a little bit first just about what you do and what you have done in the past. So, we kind of know what your background is and where you're coming from.
Sure. So Invention Arts is our website. It says rather cryptically that we think, talk, and make stuff. More specifically, we'll focus very much on the evolution of media, and particularly book publishing, and the changes that are occurring, and the things that are possible. Prior to that, well, I guess my background is really goes back to the mid-80s, where I was in New York attempting to be a writer, and I ended up writing books for a packager, and they were kind of potboilers in a way, but he got involved in nonlinear storytelling, kind of choose-your-own-adventure, branching-style books, so I ended up writing those, and I found those really fascinating, and then he asked me to adapt a novel, Rendezvous with Velma by Arthur C. Clarke, into a graphic adventure. So that kind of got me into the idea of storytelling in software form and computers as an expressive medium. What I learned there was that, it's fine to be the writer and working with story, but if you don't really understand the technology, then you're very limited. It would be like a director who doesn't know how to shoot film, attempting to make great films and not having any technique. So I got very involved in writing software and built interactive fiction systems, and then began publishing, working with Simon Schuster and others. I had a book agent, John Brockman, and he was actually selling our stories into publishers. And these were kind of adventure games that were very story-driven. And I did that as an independent for a number of years and kind of evolving different forms. For example, narrative simulations, where it would be a simulation engine which was actually running a narrative, not a set of branching stories, but kind of programmatic actors that could surprise you. And that was pretty fascinating. We did political simulations and Star Trek stories.
And were these characters then influenced by the viewer or consumer, or were they simply, was the engine running them completely?
No, it was really a combination. It was interaction of the user as a protagonist in the story, interacting with characters, but they would have their own sets of objectives.
Right.
And they could formulate what they might do. So they, the thing we're always going for is surprise. Somebody acts in a way, or emergent behavior.
Right.
Character or set of characters doing things that you didn't expect.
So it's sort of really like, right. So similar to what video game writers have had to do.
Well, that's exactly where it's gone. These were, a lot of the original branching stories were on rails, right? So you could diagram them out as a tree structure, and there's only, it's like taking a ride at the amusement park, and, that boat is on rails. It's not going anywhere that hasn't been, designed into it. But for in building the sort of programmatic behavior, you need an environment where the actors are capable of pretty much anything, and that's really the evolution of the game business, and that's where we are now, building AI into characters, building environments that may have a story frame, but where the story as it plays out, your personal story, is something that sort of occurs as a result of what you do, not just what you read or see.
Right. No, I think that's really interesting in terms of, what you've lived is essentially something that is a theme of some conversations that I've seen recently, that writers are going to have to learn new tools, including
mm-hmm.
software, if they want to participate in a truly digital expressive environment.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's really important to, and the thing is, it's a great joy to understand technology and how it works. There's nothing there that people can't understand. A lot of the time, you first have to kind of get the jargon and the core principles, but then you can extrapolate a lot from that. But it's not for everyone. And it was really interesting. I had the occasion to spend time with James Cameron, and I was telling him about narrative simulation and nonlinear storytelling. And he said, he listened really attentively, and this is around the T2, the Terminator 2 release. And then he said, well, that's fascinating, but it's not something I would ever do. And I said, well, why not? He said, because I am a storyteller who needs to be in complete, exquisite control of the effects. I take you by the nose, and I show you this, and I show you that, I show you that, and then I kill you with that.
Right, and
if you have the ability to look away, you're not going to get the effect that I've tried to put together.
Right, and I would say that all things are possible at the same time. In other words, it's certainly plausible for many viewers who only want that kind of experience. It's also plausible that at the same time there are people who want a different experience. There have been deeply literary writers and deeply literary readers, as well as popular writers and people who write short fiction, and there's long form and novellas. I mean, essentially the form of expression is unlimited, and therefore also the consumption of expression is unlimited.
I think that's right. Well, I took that a step further and built one of the first massively multiplayer online game called 10-6, which is 10 to the 6th per million. It's a million-player game, and it's still up online. It's projectvisitor.com. Sort of a ragtag fleet of players continues to play it, but this is in around 98, and we published it with Sega, and it was a story world. And that actually taught me a great deal about the limits of story in a real-time environment. But also it got me into inventing in a sort of formal sense, separating out the technology from the product. So one of the things we built was ownable digital objects and virtual property and virtual goods. And these have lately emerged as a primary mechanism for monetization on social networks. So a lot of actually innovations come out of the game business and then end up getting sort of Farmville broadly distributed to the market at large. A couple of other twists and turns there, and given the fact that I was inventing a lot and getting patents and so on a lot of the things that I did, I ended up running strategic intellectual property development for Yahoo for about 4 years, and that included content IP strategy and operations. Think about the rights issues for distributing content in a global marketplace. How do these things actually get distributed in a way that is in line with the original intent of the agreement? Or if there's no, if it's user-generated content, what are the rights there? How does that get useful to people? So that got me into a lot of the, we focused very heavily on the emergence of the social web. For a while there it was pretty buzzy, but I think people understand now that the social graph, that sort of set of connections between people that are publicly identified as real people, not as aliases. On Facebook, you are who you are. Otherwise, it's meaningless. Same thing goes for Twitter and other social technologies. But that set of services, whether they're the interest graphs of Twitter or the social graph of Facebook or the location graphs of Foursquare and now Facebook and others, all of that interesting additional data around the content, that's getting access to that, building functionality around it, consuming it, or creating it. That is the new infrastructure, obviously, of the internet. So the prior, it was really, more a broadcast kind of medium. I create a website. And then it became more of the sort of Web 2.0 model, which was I can now write onto a website with comments and blogging and so on. And now the real world is meeting the web through the medium of the things that people do, the things that they're interested in, and the things that they're saying.
Right, what you're seeing essentially is the evolution of culture adopting the tool set that people,
right.
people, we're tool people. So, or we're tool users as a being. And so people have figured out constantly new ways of using the tool set.
Right.
And of course, I guess there's a whole other question, which maybe is bigger and not necessarily apropos right now, but, what's
mm-hmm.
kind of the next generative after, if this is the third
mm-hmm.
level, what's the fourth, what's the fifth? I mean, it might get too complicated for us to even think about.
Right.
Because it is, reflexive. The information feeds other networks and makes it much more complicated. But
yeah.
I think what you're saying is that at least for culture, people who are interested in creating and consuming culture, that this changes things considerably for
yeah.
how we interact.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing. I've sort of come full circle now back to my first love, which is books and immersive storytelling, linear storytelling, and like what Cameron was talking about. That's, as the kid whose life was changed by the bookmobile,
Right,
and
there was something that you wrote in an email that I just want to read it because I thought you said this. It takes a little thinking to get this, but it's right on the point of what you're saying now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, no question there will be countless life forms in this forest, as many as can be imagined. My point is that observably, content formulation tends to stabilize around the most powerful organizing principles, and these organizing principles are necessarily derived from and mimic the structural forms of the medium. Maybe you could expound on that a little bit. I think you were referencing the music business and how
yeah.
it was being remade, but I think the suggestion is that, as you go on to talk about decentralization, what happens to books?
Right.
It's not, as you said, the question isn't whether books, et cetera, will be remade in the image of the medium at a minimum at the structural level. Each flower above the root may seem strange and original, but they're almost exclusively the same down below. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that conversation was around, different approaches to delivering books, formulating books, selling books. And if you look at I think the way I was starting that years ago, I said the digital wave will sweeps over everything from the means of production to the product itself. And transforms those things. And what I've learned in the last 20 years is, when it comes to the internet, that it not only transforms them, the internet transforms things into its own image, like a jealous god, and it wants music to be reformulated in the forms that it understands and that it is it's built at the infrastructure level to deliver. So, for example, music. Prior, there were a lot of different forms and physical forms that it was delivered in, or radio. But today, if you look at the sort of root structure of the internet, there are addresses for things, and everything has a URL or a URI. There are files that sit on servers. You can access those things in a kind of stateless way and pull them down and experience them and forward them to friends. You can do whatever you like. And so the music business, as music moved onto the net, the product itself got reformulated, and it got reformulated in the image of every other file, every other hunk of information that's available on a server and accessible through a server, and then downloaded to a client device. So on top of that, not just the product formulation, but the marketing then follows suit. If music is now a freely shareable object, then sort of command and control or centralized distribution models that rely upon scarcity and the control of the movement of the product from manufacturing to warehouse to retail.
Right. To the home. The nature of physical goods.
Yeah, that goes away. And so part of what happened there, and you see this as sort of an attempt to graft the last version of the distribution reality or the product formulation onto the internet. So DRM, digital rights management, and this is very relevant to books, I think, in the music world, the labels made every conceivable mistake as they attempted to basically recreate the physical scarcity controlled access model of physical goods on digital goods, which are inherently, infinitely copyable and shareable. And they failed. It's not possible. You can't do that. The internet remade music, and it is remaking the music distribution and retail business in the image of the core structures and dynamics of the internet. So now you see in the music business, over a period of time, DRM was extremely important to all. Obviously, this is very relevant to ebooks of a variety of formats with all of their DRM. So at first we had, these DRM models, but eventually, it was understood that there was a side effect. The labels wanted DRM for music, otherwise they wouldn't provide it to Apple or anybody else. And so Apple said, fine, we have Fairplay DRM. And that created a secondary effect, which was unanticipated, and that was device lock-in. What happened was it became very, all those people who were buying music, their libraries were married to Apple products. Their music was married to Apple products in the same way your Kindle books are married to Kindle. That's not necessarily a nefarious thing, but it's not bad if you're the device seller to have a lock-in. If I throw away my Kindle, I throw away my library now.
Right. Now, consumers not too happy with that when they're faced with the ramifications. One of the things that always drove me crazy about the iPod was that if I didn't own an iPod or an iPad or whatever it is, an iPhone, I could not readily listen to that music. And I could play it on my computer. Yeah, I could stream it on my home network, but I still had to use the system, the software systems that are created by Apple.
Yep, you're married to it. And at a certain point, actually, in the case of Apple, it was a European directive that was coming down. I think France was sort of driving it. They were going to force Apple to publish the details of their DRM system because it was viewed as non-competitive once they had a dominant market share. And so Apple had, Steve Jobs had a brilliant response, and that was, well, we only put DRM on these files because you asked for it, music industry. Let's imagine a world where there is no DRM. And in fact, shortly thereafter, to create a sort of counter to Apple, Amazon was given MP3, un-DRM'd MP3 access, a huge catalog. And then Apple followed suit shortly thereafter. They were given the ability to sell music without digital rights management. It turns out that consumers, serving the needs of the rights holders is important, but to the extent it's inimical to the enjoyment and experience of the consumer, it eventually goes away. And that's what happened in the music business. And if you look at the music business and those two players, Apple and Amazon, you realize when it comes to books, this is not the first time at the rodeo for these people when it comes to DRM. And one has to imagine, given that there are such smart people there that deeply understand these things, whether or not there is, and I can only speculate, but whether or not there is a conscious understanding that at a certain point those lock-in DRM mechanisms will give way to freely available formats so I can transfer my books between devices because the consumer and the evolution of the medium and the audience demands it.
I think that it seems likely because it's basically always going to be true that if you want to sell things, you have to do what the customer wants.
Right.
Ultimately, there is always a balance between what the creator wants and what the consumer wants. That's a fair tension to exist. But ultimately, the consumer who has the money to spend is the one who will decide where that line is drawn.
Right.
And the economics on the other side have to adjust, I think, to what the customer wants.
And some people win and some people lose. And that's life.
So let's move like a step beyond to the book side.
Yep.
What's really interesting to me now is that you've come up with a new invention, I guess, because your company is called Invention Arts. You've created that thing called AirBooks, AirBook, AERBOOK.
Right, and so, right.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I think that it is a really interesting evolution of your thinking, you know, in terms of where the book and the reader connect.
Right, and I think that there are, you know, a number of people that are thinking the same kind of thing, like Peter Bradley at the Book Server Project, and I guess you interviewed Peter last week, or Hugh McGuire, Joseph Pearson, another person well worth looking into, who built something called Monocle, but which is a web-based reader. So if you jump ahead, if we say that we can learn from the fact that the medium, it will be remade in the form of the forms required by the internet and its audiences, and you look at the structure of the product, then you would say that a book should be a number of things. A book should have an address. Every book should have a URL, just like every video. Or, you know, I can send you a link, and it will load an MP3 file, and you'll hear it immediately. Not a page with a picture of the artist and a button, a play button. I can just send you a link to the music itself, or a picture, or a video, or what have you.
Well, is there a problem with the size of the file, or is that not an issue?
Well, it's not an issue because, you know, it will be streamed. All you're sending is a link. You're sending a reference to where the book lives online. If you jump ahead, you say, okay, well, a book needs an address, and that means that the book lives on the internet. It doesn't live in a file that's encapsulated with DRM or something else that has to be downloaded and installed. It's, you know, by sending the link, you start reading the book.
Right, essentially. Now, what you're describing is, in effect, what you said before, that the book is, in this model, remade into the internet itself.
Yes.
You know, everything is a set of, I mean, the internet is basically a web of pointers with logical addresses and pathways to get to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you instantly worry about, you know, this sort of, the worry about that is because we're so used to owning something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe this is simply a temporary stage in the development, because so many people who feel that urge to own will no longer be around in a few years, and maybe the digital natives of the world will not. I mean, this will become natural to them because they're so used to having. They buy access; they don't buy products.
Right. Well, yeah, there was a term in the music business, the celestial jukebox.
Right.
Remember that one. So I think it's inevitable that we move to the notion of a celestial bookshelf. And, you know, my 13-year-old will, you know, just assume that that you can point at a book and read it. That doesn't mean that I don't want a physical book or that I don't want something for my Kindle, because Kindle delivers, you know, tremendous value to me. I mean, I actually, with an iPad and a Kindle, I tend to think of the Kindle as almost the analog form of the book, because I can easily take it to the beach, or, you know, take an iPad to the beach.
Right, but there you're still talking about the device becomes less relevant. It's the device is simply the mechanism by which you access.
Right.
You know, so you're building portability there. You know, I think of, you know, maybe as the devices, I think there's a lot of evolution in the machinery side. But
mm-hmm.
I think what you're talking about is really more a conceptual idea. That's what I find, you know, really interesting here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that engagement with book is based on the same model as engagement with the web.
Right. And there's one aspect of that. I think that increasingly, you know, as a kind of part of this, that there is something, the bookness of a book is really important. And by that I mean the experience of turning pages. It's not simply mimicking the physical world. There's something about it which seems to sort of recapitulate or evoke the sense of the passage of time, that there is a progression, right? when it's left to right. And I may be wrong, but I think it has something to do, and I haven't really thought it through, but, you know, sort of deeply rooted in our cognitive processes of looking across the horizon, or the sense of time passage. So simply putting a book onto a web page and, you know, an endless scroll that goes down into hell isn't really the same thing as a book, right? There's something about that form that I think is important. And lends to that sort of immersive experience that you get when you read a book.
No, that may, I think that may reflect also that the bookness has evolved over hundreds and hundreds of years based on the interaction of people and technology. You know,
right.
More rudimentary technology, but still, I think in that sense you're right. We seem to like pagination as part of the experience. Of reading. You know, if you do have a scrolling file that goes on and on and on, people tend to get dizzy on some level. So it may be that it's a form of anchoring for us. And you know, probably smarter people than me have figured this out, but I think you're probably right. There is there are technical points where book design from the world of physical books that evolved over many years of use apply to the consumption of information in the digital environment.
Right. It's instantly recognizable, and it cues a kind of different experience for you. It's just like there's a film grammar, and, you know, when you see somebody looking off screen, you know that the next shot you're going to see is what they're looking at, this kind of an aesthetics that we understand, and I'm not sure quite where that comes from. So if you start with the notion that a book should be infinitely shareable, and then you look at the other sort of mechanisms that have emerged, or the new infrastructure, books should be social. A book should be shareable. It should be susceptible to the social gestures of liking, sharing, that kind of thing. One of the things that we've got now is with Twitter and Facebook, and I'm not just a sort of mindless cheerleader for those things, but I am an admirer and sort of in awe of the change in the infrastructure, and that is that, you know, people are now identified, you know, as people. It used to be that joke, you know, nobody on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Well, now they know your name, you know, and in fact, they know increasingly where you are. You're publishing your travel plans, or I can see. I can get a sense of who you are by looking at the people that are your friends on Facebook or your Twitter followers, and there's a range of other mechanisms like that. So those kinds of things, and then the marketing mechanisms, all those things need to apply. So Airbook, which we built we'll be basically lighting it up in the next, probably lit up by now, offers a few things. One is, it's built on Monocle by Joseph Pearson, which is this sort of web reader. We take either a full book or excerpts of the book and publish them on the web. And then I can just email you the link, just like I can email you a link to an MP3, and it loads the book, and you can start flipping through the pages and reading it and understanding it, why you might like it, why you might want to own another edition of it, or you might experience the entire book. Some of the writers we're working with actually want to publish their books in that format from the get-go, and in fact build them over time, because they understand that that it's really not about the format so much when it comes to electronic publishing. It's about finding readers and involving people at that stage. For some writers, makes a lot of sense.
Well, and the interactivity, I mean, I think of that as certainly a powerful thing. If you're thinking about an idea and you want to have input in your thinking from the readers for whom you are writing in the first place, that's a really powerful, you know, that's what a blog can offer, but in a lot of ways this is taking that to another level and kind of, and again, as we talked about before, it may not work for every writer not every writer is a social being who wants to have input from the readership while writing. Some writers are solitary, they want to talk only to themselves until they're ready to release it to some other, to a larger audience. But I think there's I can see instantly how it could be very powerful for many writers, especially writers who feel that they're involved inherently in a social activity.
Yeah. Well, and also the book should be should have sort of built-in social gestures. I should be, and those are things like I like it, or I tweet it, or I email it, I rate it, I comment on it. Those kinds of things. Not always good for the experience. So, in our view, that needs to be something that is, you know, that's something that you click to see. It's not something that should be intrusive on a book experience. Book experience needs to be one that does not have a lot of characters, you know, around the fringes chattering away.
Right, unless you want that.
Unless you want them, right.
Yeah.
And then another aspect of this is to give, you know, and you're seeing this increasingly with major brands have figured this out, that their products or their company, but frequently their products, do better and connect with people better if they have their own social identities. And I know that sounds a little nuts, but you have a flattening of the market architecture. It used to be sort of a, you know, factory and a marketing is madman kind of world sending products down Glowcoat down to me. Now Glowcoat has its own Twitter account, and it talks to you and it engages with people. So having a flattened kind of peer-to-peer relationship with a product is important. And the same thing, and that's an aspect of your book as well, is to give the books their own social identities. It's not the identity of the publisher or the writer per se, it's the book. So, for example, working with research publications, sort of legendary publisher of alternative culture, they have a book called Modern Primitives, which 20 years ago launched the sort of revolution in body modification. It's a classic alongside a range of others. You know, so that gets its own social identity, and it begins to connect with people. And it's a little bit like interacting with the persona of the book.
Right. Well, essentially, you're creating as you know a kind of a model of publishing that is similar to the way that other more recognizable commercial products are being treated by audiences or by consumers.
Right. Well, they figured it out, and they have the metrics. You know, it's no accident that Old Spice campaign, which you know put a character, the Old Spice guy, up on the screen, and you could send him messages, and he was recording videos and answering those messages. It flattened out the architecture. Now it's a peer-to-peer relationship and a personification. Now, you can't turn every book into an Old Spice guy, obviously.
No, and I think there are certainly specific books and specific authors whose books who will not want to participate in that particular version of how the conversation works, that they want to have more like James Cameron. They want to control every single element of storytelling as well as perhaps packaging. I mean, I think of some writers that I remember Robert Duncan, the poet, who was furious at typos or changes introduced to his poems by the typographer, that the literal placement of the letter on the page was part of the art experience, and he would not brook it being in the wrong place. So, you know, there are many different forms of how the literary world will be expressed. But I think what you're doing, is, at least from what I can tell, is you're creating a kind of evolutionary model for how some of those books and authors and readers are going to interact.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and the reality is that there is no modification to the book itself. It's giving the book a social identity, gives it the capabilities of any other identity on the web. So one of the things we have built over the last year is a social curation technology, because we're applying it to books, and I can describe that. So what you have in, and it's very much focused on Twitter, and I always feel foolish saying the word Twitter, but it's a powerful transport for interest. It's really not the social graph. The interest graph, and they're very, you know, clear about that. You can find thousands of topics and millions of people that are interested in the same things that you're interested in, and then follow those and get, you know, updates, news, and so on. And what you have is sort of ad hoc communities of interest. Well, you can think of a book as the centerpiece or the focal point for an ad hoc community of interest. Clay Gordon, who's a a writer about chocolate and a sort of an expert and authority about chocolate. You know, he's at the center of a community of people who think seriously about chocolate. Stephen Culpan, who's won the James Beard Award for Wine Wise last year, we're working with him as well. He's the chair of the wine department at the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park. And there's an enormous community of people that are interested in wine, and then sub-communities based around that. So what they're doing on the social networks, particularly these streaming real-time media networks like Twitter and others, Buzz and others, is they're publicly declaring their interest in a topic which is relevant to books by these authors or publishers. And so the social curation technology, which kind of sort of, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's actually pretty accurate, we call Reader Radar, we feed it some terms. It might be Napa wine or, you know, Coppola Rubicon wine, or it could be David Sedaris as a term, you know, because somebody may be doing a sort of edgy urban essays, and they'd like to know, and they think, rightly or wrongly, but maybe reasonably, that people who like David Sedaris might like their book too. So the radar chews through every few minutes the entire corpus of Twitter comments and also public Facebook posts, and it finds those comments that contain the terms that express the interest. If it's David Sedaris, find everything every few minutes whenever anyone mentions David Sedaris, copies those into a big database, sorts them out, but it also makes a record of the people who said those things. Remember, this is not invasive of privacy because these are explicitly public utterances. And so we end up with a database of millions of people mapped to thousands of interests, and we have the things that they've said, or Radar finds the things that they've said, and then that becomes available for the book. Or whoever is sort of managing the book's persona, it makes potential readers visible. And so the book can then, and that's part of the AirBook service, is the radar. It's perusing and browsing hundreds or thousands of people who may be interested in the book. And that's the marvel of, you know, real people who are contactable, who provide their bios, and who publicly express and declare interests that are relevant to the book, being able to organize those, and then the book's social identity, book Twitter's account follows them. And when that happens, those people get an email from Twitter that says, a sense of place is now following you. And here's the icon, and the bio is, it's a book about an intimate portrait of the Niebaum Coppola estate, now the Rubicon estate. And, you know, follow us for a range of interesting information. And the people that the book is following are people who have expressed an interest in wine and Northern California wine and whatever, and there are lots of them. And so you take that notion of ad hoc interest groups and find them and crystallize them in lists that you can browse and sort of curate a potential readership. We think that that's one of the most powerful things that flows from the social web and publicly declared interest graphs, and that's part of the book, too. Once they get those emails, then they can go to the Twitter landing page for the book, and there's a link, and what do you know, it loads the book and start reading it. So kind of pull that loop together, and then the book itself has Facebook like buttons in it.
I think this is going to be a really interesting direction for publishing. I really do think this is amazing. I have to end us now. I think we've reached the end of our time, but it's been really interesting talking to you. I've been talking to Ron Martinez of Invention Arts, and his new project is called AirBook, AERBOOK.com. I highly recommend taking a look. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book business, talking to Ron Martinez. Thanks so much.
Thank you.